We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you via the ETIM Network, the online, live, interactive division of Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Just a reminder to everybody, if you have a Tanakh available to you, that's the best possible scenario. I will occasionally skip around to Tanakh, but it slows things down a little bit to go to Tanakh. But tonight's shiur, and it's 8 o'clock on my clock, so I will begin. Tonight's shiur is the second of a two-part series, although today's shiur will be mostly independent of the work of the stuff that we did last week. Occasionally I'll reference things. I see that one person at least was here last week, but I see a few new squares or a few new faces or places where faces should be, so I will occasionally dip back into last week, but not spend too much time on it. And now to the shiur. I want to just do a review, and I apologize. I know Mordechai in Toronto probably heard this a little bit, but it's important to establish the concept of metaphor that's used in Shlomo's books. Of course, I mentioned yesterday when I say Shlomo's books, I mean inspired by Shlomo, transmitted from Shlomo. Authorship is actually not given to Shlomo. It's given to King Hezekiah some 300 years later, and even that may be later than that, since it says Hezekiah and his school or his band. So it's hard exactly to pinpoint the date. But they are Solomon's work in the sense that that is our Mesorah, that Solomon is the source of the wisdom, which shows up in the three great wisdom books, the Song of Songs, and Proverbs, Song of Songs being Shir HaShirim, Proverbs being Mishlei, and Kohelet being Ecclesiastes. In all three books, and they are quite related, they borrow from each other's language. Shir HaShirim borrows from Mishlei, Mishlei borrows from Kohelet. They're really quite intertwined in some, at least in idioms occasionally, if not in actual concepts, and there are concepts that cross over. But in all three books, there is a great emphasis on the concept of metaphor. Metaphor was the way the great poets spoke. So Kohelet seems, to be honest, the least metaphoric of all of them. Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, either you buy that it's a metaphor about something and that the love story is merely the surface layer of something that is much deeper. But even in Shir HaShirim, when the boy is talking about the girl, he speaks metaphorically. Your lips are like strings or like ribbons of silk. Sometimes simile, but sometimes metaphor as well. So there's metaphors on top of metaphors on top of metaphors. Of course, the Book of Mishlei is all about all metaphors, really. That's essentially the whole idea. While we call it Proverbs, there's a great deal of metaphors in it, and if you're not always looking for the metaphor, sometimes you think things are just as they seem, when in fact that they are not. Here, too, I want to just demonstrate that Kohelet uses metaphor as well to express his ideas. So we'll take 2 minutes going over something that we did last week, and I would ask you to open up your Tanakhs to the last chapter of the book. And I'm going to flip over to now on the screen so we could all take a look at it. And I'm going to go to chapter 12. So hopefully that's showing up on your screen. Let me just check to see if it is. Yes, it is. Verse 1 really is talking about appreciating life while you're young, and while you're young, pay attention to the fact that the death comes, the end comes, and you really have to be careful about how one behaves during one's life. And here in verse 3, which I'm highlighting, all the way down to pretty much here in verse 6, Pasuk Zion, we are in metaphor land, and really when one reads it at first, it's not clear at all what he's talking about. So I'll read it through and then explain it. Bayom sheyazu shomrei habayit, in the day, that day, that is at the end when the darkness comes and the clouds go after the wind, and very poetic in the previous verse. It says, "B'yom she'azu shomrei abayit," when the guardians of the house or the castle begin to shake, she'azu, the heat of tu anshei achayil, and bent becomes the men of the men of war, or the soldiers, or perhaps the men of valor, start to become bent. Uvatlu atochanot kimietu, and the grinding mills begin to be abandoned or to cease because there are so few of them. The chashchu haraot ba'arubot, and there are very few lookouts in the places on the walls where one looks out from the city. The sugru da'atayim bashuk, and the doors close in the marketplace. Bishval kol atachanaz, the sound of the grinding mills becomes weakened. The akum kol atzipur, and it arises to the voice of the birds. Vayishachu kol benot shir, and all the singers are silent. All of this is metaphor. They are not talking about a city here. Shlomo is not talking about a city. He's talking about a person. Shomrei Abayit are, of course, the arms. Anshei Achayil are the legs that become bent. The Tochanot Kimietu are the teeth that fall apart and can no longer chew food. Ra'ot Baruvot are when the eyes start to dim and darken. Latayim Bishuk Bishval Kol HaTachana is the lips start to close. The mouth becomes closed all the time because there's no teeth, so the lips sink back in on themselves. Vayishachu kol benot shir, the voice starts to go. So all of this is a metaphor. Now we sort of come out of the metaphor a little bit in the next verse. Gam gavoah yirav v'chatim aderech. So I could assume that I'm talking about a city here, but really we're saying that a person is afraid when he walks that he might fall in the cracks. Vayineitza shakevish tabelach agav aterev avyona. Well, these are all either animals or organisms that die out on a regular basis, sometimes a quick basis. We're really talking about the human life. Adasher, in Pasuk Vav, Adasher lo yeratek chevel hakesef. Chevel hakesef is the spine, and it snaps. The tarutz gulat azahav, and the golden ball starts to run away, which is the skull. Vatishaber kadal amabua. It falls onto the watered ground. The narot al galgalabor, and then finally the skull falls into the bor, the cistern. But essentially, we're talking about the grave here. And then in the next pasuk, then we say ve'ashov ha'afar la'ruach, and then the earth returns to the ground. So we know we're talking about death. But the whole section beforehand is a metaphor, and Shlomo uses those metaphors without telling us that he's going to use metaphors. I'm going to come back into the screen now. Just a second. Okay, there we go. So, in various parts of Kohelet, one really has to be on the lookout for possible metaphoric speech. As I mentioned last week's shir, the shemesh, in my opinion, a careful read of the text, will show that shemesh is a metaphor. Takola takara shemesh means as long as you're alive. And choshech is a metaphor for death, and it's a pretty straightforward metaphor. Another one, though, which one really has to be careful about, is in the very first chapter, when Kohelet seems to be talking about the four elements. I will read you that text. If you'd like to, you can go to Kohelet chapter 1, and Kohelet speaks about the ocean in verse. In verse 7, in Pasuk Zion, Kol ha'nechalim, all of the rivers, holchim el hayam, flow into the water, v'hayam enenu malei, but yet the ocean never becomes filled up. Now, this seems to be one of those things of cyclical nature, the four elements. First, you talk about the earth, and then fire, and then water, and wind, and yet there's something else going on here. That is, it seems to be he's talking just about nature and how there's inevitability of nature because everything runs into the sea, yet the sea never becomes any higher. However, if you would turn to chapter 6, verse 7. So I'll just take a few seconds if you would take a look there. If you don't have a Tanakh, I will read everything out. Chapter 6, verse 7 reads as follows. Kol amal ha'adam lifihu. Everything that a man works for goes into his mouth. V'gam ha'nefesh lo timalei. And yet the soul, the physical soul in this sense, never gets filled up, which means you eat, and you get hungry again, you eat, you get hungry again, you keep eating, and yet there's really no way to satisfy that basic primal urge, and so it all seems to be going down the tube, or seems sort of, you work, and you hope to get to some point where you don't have to work anymore, but yet it all comes back to the beginning, which means, if you notice, those psukim are very close, but in the first pasuk it's talking about the rivers flowing into the ocean. And in this pasuk is talking about how a man works, or mankind, a man or woman, works in order to get food which goes into his mouth, but ultimately a person gets hungry again. But based on the fact that the two psukim are parallel, it may be that in the first chapter, where we thought he was talking about the ocean was simply a metaphor for the human desire to sustain itself. So one really needs to be careful about these type of things. I don't say it has to be. And the nice thing about metaphor is I could say something that could work on, you know, both levels. It could work on one hand on the simple, plain sense, and on the other hand it could be the metaphoric meaning, which is the beautiful thing about a metaphor. It really supports not only two levels of meanings, but sometimes multiple level of meanings. And the final one I want to go to is one of the psukim, which I think may be a metaphor, although you kind of have to make your own assessment. And that is in chapter 3. And the reason why I'm bringing it up is not so much to stress metaphors, but because chapter 3 is far away one of the difficult psukim where people wonder, hey, is this Kohelet guy even from? Why is this book in our holy books at all if he's speaking in such anti-Jewish ways or a-Jewish ways? So let's take a look and see what he says in chapter 3. I'm going to scoot on over there for a second and show you the text. So if you'll bear with me. I'm going to scoot on over to chapter 3 of Kohelet. If you notice at the top, hopefully you can see that. Let me just check if you can see that. Right, of course, the top is the famous song. I don't remember if anybody has a microphone or they could key in. What was the name of that band in the 60s? A Time to Live, A Time to Die. So, of course, that's right here from the beginning of the famous chapter 3 of Kohelet. But what I'm more interested in right now is this little section down below. Let me see if somebody mentioned to me what the... No, nobody is... all right, well, if anybody remembers which is the mamas and the papas, I don't remember. But in any event, let's take a look at chapter 3. I'm going to highlight the text that I'd like to take a look at and show you where metaphor can be very significant, or at least needs to be considered. So I'm highlighting from verse 18 to verse 21. And I'll get back more to this verse because it's very critical. Let me take a look. Somebody, the birds. Thank you very much, Kenneth. The birds, very good. What would I do without the audience? Thank you. So the birds, of course, stole it. I doubt they paid any royalties to God, but or to Shlomo, or to Chizkiyahu, but they certainly should have. If you take a look at verse 18, it says something very interesting. Amarti ani b'libi, I said to myself, al divrat bnei Adam, on the issue or on the occurrence of man, Livaram ha'elohim, of God to choose them. Now, I'm taking a very specific translation here. Rashi and other Mefarshim and his students, Rav Yosef Karo and the Rashi, go in a different direction. It's God purifying them. But I think here it comes with the word borer, livror, to select man. And I'll, as I get more into chapter 3 a little bit later in this year, I'll explain why I'm saying that. But let's continue for now. V'lirot shehim behemahim alehem. So he's playing around with the alliteration of Hema and Behema. We're saying really they're really all just animals. Why? Because in verse 19 it says, Ki mikra b'nei adam mikra behema, because what happens to a man or what happens to an animal, u'mikra echad lehem, it's all the same. Ki motzeh, ki motzeh. Just like a man dies, so does an animal die. V'ruachecha l'chol. They all have the same spirit. U'motar ha'adam min ha'beima ayin ki akol havel. And man has no advantage over an animal because everything is transient. Everything disappears. Right now, it seems to be saying, when you say ruach echad l'chol, if we understand ruach as spirit, which is the way I translated it, we seem to be on very heretical grounds. Really, there's no difference between an animal and a man when it comes to the big picture of things. Now, you could say that ruach means the animated spirit, that is, the fact that they both alive and therefore both die. And in that sense, it's true, animals really don't, a man doesn't have an advantage in the fact that man dies and animal dies. But in the next psukim, it seems a little bit more challenging. Hakol holech ha'makol machad. Every hakol, assumingly man and animal, all go to the same place, i.e. into the dirt. Hakol hayah min afar. Everything comes out of the dirt. Hakol shavel afar, or dust, and everything goes back to the dust. Mi odea ruach bei adam holehi lemala. And I'm going to translate it, I believe, incorrectly. But I'm going to stick with my incorrect translation, which is how all the modern translations do it, because they assume that Shlomo is questioning the afterlife. Mi odea ruach bnei adam holehi lamala. Who can know whether the spirit of man is going to go up, i.e. to the heavens? V'ruach ha-behima ha-yoredet hi lamata l'aretz. And whether the animal spirit simply goes down to the ground. Now, this seems very heretical on a few fronts. This seems to be questioning the transcendence of the human spirit. So, besides the fact that I sort of mistranslated it, and I'm going to get to how I believe is the better translation, which really does away with the heresy, although it's still a tough question, I'm not entirely sure behema means an animal. I don't want to take to the text. I'm going to escape out now so that I go back into video mode. So just a second. Okay. So I want to just point out, I'm not going to open up the text. If you have a Tehillim, when you get a chance, you could take a look at Tehillim 22, Chaf Bet, where David is complaining that he's surrounded by cows. C-O-W-S. And he is complaining about the cows. Parota Bashan. And everybody understands that he's not talking about real cows. I mean, it's not like David is surrounding by, you know, cows and they're all going moo and David's freaking out and feels that he needs to write it to Tehillim. Obviously, cows and the animals in Tehillim 22 are referring to bad people. And if you take a close look at Rashi on the first of the pasuk that I highlighted, he does hint to this idea. He doesn't really stick to it, but he hints to the idea that we're talking about Adam being a tzaddik and the behema being kind of like behaving like a rasha. Now, I'm oversimplifying Rashi, but it is possible that the little section is a little bit metaphoric and that things are not not everything is what meets the eye. However, I'm going to actually attack the chapter in a slightly different way. I just wanted to point out that as we're reading Kohelet, keep in mind there may be metaphor behind the scenes. And now let's get to... Now I'd like to sort of go back to the central thesis I must do one more. If you would take a look at chapter 7, verse 25, and I think I'll go to the text right now just so I can show everybody that text. And then hopefully that will be my last comment on metaphor and on heresy for that matter. So let me just switch on over there. I'm going to chapter 7, verse 25. Okay. And he's talking about a woman here. And not in the best of terms, to be perfectly honest. So let's highlight the text right here at the bottom. And it says, Saboti ani v'libi ladat v'latur. So I kind of spun myself around. Saboti ani. I turned myself around. I changed direction. To look for intelligent cheshbon probably doesn't mean financial here. It probably means what it does in Mishle, which is plotting and trying to figure out how to get things to work just the way you want them to do. I'm not going to translate that. I'm going to just go on to point out the women. I find something worse, more bitter than death. What is it? Asharhim Sodim, the woman who is who traps you, and so that is a trap. Charanim liba, and she has blasphemy, perhaps the word charanim or something that kind of cuts you out of life in her heart. Asurim yadeha, her hands tie you up there like chains. Tov lifnei Elohim yimaleit mimenu, run away from her. It's best to run away from this kind of woman. The chote yilaked ba, and a sinner will truly get trapped in her. Re'ezem atzati, etc. Exam Marco Helad, achat la'achat, limso cheshbon, asher od biksha nashi, etc. etc. Adam achat ne elef matzati, vishab chole lelo matzati. A real terrible kind of statement against women. Now, if we go, however, later on, I'm not going to go there, but to a little later on, it talks about all that one could really appreciate is having a partner, a woman who's a partner in one's life. And what I wanted to point out here is that in this chapter 7, I don't think we're talking about a real woman. And if you take a look at Mishle, I'm going to close out of the presentation. If you take a look at a Mishle, the first 9 chapters are preoccupied with two kinds of women. One's called Chochmah, who is clearly a personification, a metaphor for wisdom. And another woman, Isha Zara, if you read carefully, she's not a woman at all. She is a personification of anti-wisdom. That's the woman who traps you, and the language is very similar. So at the end of chapter 7, I don't think Mishle is talking about women. That's not the wisdom he's coming across. And if you read it simply without the metaphor, then that seems to be what's going on. But a careful reader, the first 9 chapters of Mishle will demonstrate that that woman that he's talking about, who traps you with her arms and her legs and her words, that woman is not a real woman whatsoever. That woman is following what's called anti-chachma, or rejecting God's ways, which is why it says la-choteh. The choteh is the one who gets trapped by her, because essentially he follows her ways. And again, that is a metaphor, and it's not a sign of of Kohelet contradicting himself. In one chapter 7, he says, I can't find a single woman, and yet in chapter 9, he says there's nothing better than finding the one woman that you love and just staying with her, because they're two separate issues. The second one is talking about a real woman, I think, and the first one is not. Now I'd like to essentially go to the theory of my thesis, if you will, for Sefer Kohelet and how to understand this book, which, regardless of whether we say that things are metaphor or not metaphor, the one thing that's quite clear is that he seems to be going in different directions. Sometimes he's happy, sometimes he's sad, sometimes he has solutions, sometimes he's not. Sometimes he feels there's all hope, and sometimes he feels things are hopeless. Sometimes he says work, 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 because it's all great, and then another time he says it's not worth doing anything because you're all going to die anyway, and all your work will go to a son who doesn't even understand you and is, you know, not intelligent, and therefore it's not worth anything. And it goes round and round, in fact. And you might say, as you're reading Kohelet, in chapter 2 he says nothing better than appreciating your lot, eating and drinking and being happy what you have. Then he goes through this whole conniption, and then later on in chapter 4 he says the same thing. And then in chapter 6 he says close to the same thing. He goes back to this over and over again, although he expresses it in slightly different ways. So my teacher, one of my teachers, Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun, says that essentially we have multiple characters in Kohelet. That does not mean that Kohelet has psychological problems, that he's schizophrenic. That's not what we mean here. What he meant to say is that Kohelet is what Rav Yoel ben Nun, and similar Rav Meidan, from what I understand, although I didn't hear Rav Meidan directly on it, is that Kohelet is presented something akin to a Greek play, where there are a series of characters. One is the pessimist, one is the optimist, one is the person who fears God, and these characters get a different chance to speak on the stage. Now, the fact that we don't see it that way, because we just have one linear text, so we get confused and we don't realize that there are different people communicating. And in fact, last year was really all about showing that there's one kind of Kohelet talking at the beginning of the book where everything is circular and you know everything and therefore it leads to despair, as opposed to chapter 11 and 12, which is the last section of the book, which is things are linear and you really don't know what might happen. And the fact that you don't know what might happen means you can gamble on things and that life is very much worth living. So the way the Rav Yoel ben Nun would express it is that those are two separate characters, and Kohelet is really expressing the essential types of human beings who might approach these philosophical and theological issues. However, what I'd like to demonstrate, I'm going to differ from Rabbi Yoel ben Nun a little bit, and I'm going to show that the text supports a slightly different reason for all this going back and forth, which is this. Kohelet, there's one Kohelet, not multiple Kohelets. However, Kohelet is doing what we do every day. Some days you have good days, and you wake up, and you understand, and you feel like you're close to God, and you understand, you feel like you're having a great time, and you're a good parent, and everything is going well, and work is perfect. And other days you wake up and you go, what am I doing here? I mean, everything I'm doing is bland. Do I really want to do all this? That is, Kohelet doesn't represent, I think, different characters of different personalities. I think he represents the internal conflict in us. And where most other books in Tanakh, a single character takes a single position. Eov takes a single position. Most of our Nevi'im take single positions. Kohelet is the first one to say, I changed my mind. Some days I feel one way, and some days I feel another way. In fact, I'm going to take it a step further and say as follows, that Kohelet is a series of theses and antitheses. My thesis is that the book is about thesis and antithesis. That is the idea of phases in his life. And Chazal go with this a little bit by saying that when he was young and I don't want to say naive, but had the whole world in front of him, so he wrote Sefer Shir Hashirim. And then when Shlomo was middle-aged and wiser, so he wrote Mishle. And then when he was more old and pessimistic, so he wrote Sefer Kohelet. But it's not really fair, because there are optimistic things in Kohelet. So one could say that these were series of his lives where he felt differently. That's certainly possible. But what I would like to argue, I can't prove it, what I'd like to argue is that he actually sat down at some point of his life and say, I'm going to take all my feelings and all my thoughts and all my intellect, and I'm going to test them out one against the other. I believe now it's absolutely true that it could have been written in different phases of his life, but Shlomo was such a gargantuan intellect, and I believe intellectually honest, that I think he could have sat down and said, this is how I'm going to explore my ideas. Although, to be honest, there is some repetition in Sefer Kohelet, and it may be Shlomo revisiting things at different points in his life. But I'm going to do things synchronically. That is, rather than looking at things diachronically, where things are taking place at different times, so I'm going to take a look at things synchronically and assume that all of Kohelet is written at the same time, and he's really going thesis, antithesis, antithesis. It may not be right, but let's see if it pans out. So let me find the first pasuk that I want to demonstrate. Just a second. I want to make sure I have the right place. Yes. Okay. So if you go to what I call the second chapter, but it's actually chapter one, verse 12 is the beginning, but there he just identifies himself. Ani Kohelet, Ayiti Melech Yisrael B'Yushalayim. And then he goes on to actually express a very important idea, which I think is what I'm speaking about, this concept of wanting to lay out thesis and antithesis. And why don't we read through the Perek a little bit, or that pasuk in particular, and take a look and see what he's saying. The way that I'm interpreting that pasuk is as follows. I am compelled, said Kohelet, to investigate. That is, I would be so happy. You know, I remember, I could say I lived in Israel for many years. The happiest times that I spent in Israel, and it was all very good, but certainly if I wanted to increase my happiness in Israel, I would avoid watching the show Politica, where all the politicians yell at each other, and I would avoid reading the newspaper, to be perfectly honest, because what you don't know doesn't bother you. And Shlomo, I think, is saying, listen, I would love to be happy with ignorance. I would walk around and do my business and not care about anything. But God has given to humankind I don't want to say inevitable, that's not the right word, a compulsion to investigate, to explore, to doubt, to look for answers. That's the Inyan Ra. That's the Inyan Ra. I see a comment from David Sal, but just a second. I'm not sure I understand the comment though, David. So if you could express it a different way, I'm not sure what you mean. You mean their desire to investigate, or the fact that they like the politics? I'm not sure what you mean. But what I think the pasuk is saying, yes, they don't read newspapers. So I'm saying, yeah, but they have all the posters on the walls, those political posters on the walls. That's the Meir Sharon version of, that's the version. You know, you're right. And David, what you're saying, I'm not saying that it's a good thing. I'm saying that it would be a nice thing except for insulation. But even if it wasn't insulation, I can't help but read what's happening. I'm compelled to know what's going on around me. Now that, I don't want to, you know, draw the metaphor too tightly. In one case, it's the news that's going around you, and the other one is the answers to the big questions of life. Why am I here? What is my connection with God? Is anything I'm doing have any use whatsoever? Why do I have to die? And then what happens afterwards? And, you know, those huge questions. And I think what Shlomo is saying is, I am compelled to answer them. And that is what I'm suffering. I am suffering with the idea that I have no choice but to ask. And if we take a look, and I'm not going to go to the video mode, hopefully you all have Tanakh, but if you don't, I will read it to you. If we continue on in chapter 1, the next verse, let's just take a look. I think the psukim support the way I'm reading it. Ra'iti kol ha'asim sh'nasu takar ha'shamash. So I saw everything that was done in this world. I say takar ha'shamash means while one is alive, as I said with the metaphor before. V'hineya kol hevel ru'ut ruach. It's all transient. Ru'ut, I think, is from the Aramaic. Everybody goes sort of nuts on the word ru'ut. Different commentaries, different answers. If you have five commentators on the word ru'ut, you have ten comments on the word ru'ut. But I think ru'ut, the correct commentary is, it comes from the Aramaic ra'ah, which is to desire, like rotseh, because the ayin and the tzadi are interchangeable. That is, it's all chasing after the wind. Muvat lo yuchal itkon. That's not talking about the things in the world. That's talking about my ability to comprehend the things in the world. Muvat lo yuchal itkon, because things that are broke, that are twisted, who could fix them? That is, who could set them right in my mind? Why do I know that? Why do I believe that that's the correct translation? Because the next part of the pasuk says, the chesron lo yuchal yimanot, which means, how am I supposed to count everything that's missing? If it's missing, how am I supposed to know it's not there? That's talking about man's capacity to comprehend. So I said to myself, So I added wisdom on everybody who is before me on Jerusalem. And by the way, do not assume that this can't be Shlomo. Some critics say that this can't be Shlomo because he was one of the first people in Yerushalayim. Only David was before him. But that's, I believe, a misread of the pasuk. It should be, Vosati chokma e al kol asher hayalafanai, on anybody who came before, Al Yerushalayim, that is Hosati Chokma Al Yerushalayim, as I became over Jerusalem. But anyway, I'll leave that alone for right now. V'libi ra'a harbe chokma dat, I saw a lot of knowledge. V'etnal libi, and I gave over my knowledge. V'adat chokma, which means I sold myself into this idea of comprehending. V'adat holy lupta sechlut, and I tried to understand everything, the wise, the foolish. Yadati shegam zer rayon ruach, but I'm chasing the wind. Why? Ki barov chokma rov kas, because the more you know, the more you suffer, Yosef dat, Yosef machov, and the more you add to your knowledge, the more you add to your pain, because ultimately you can't know everything. He's not talking about what he sees here, Shlomo, Kohelet is not. Kohelet is talking about the act of pursuing knowledge. It reminds me of when I used to study when I did my master's in Yeshiva University. So if anybody's been there, so I used to go to the fifth floor, I used to hang out in what they call as Medrash Elyon, and I used to go to the fifth floor of the library. And there are thousands, tens of thousands of books. And if I was doing a project for one of the great professors that they have there, I would really read a huge amount of material, thousands of pages. I would read, 50 books on a subject. 50 books is that much space on one shelf of the library. And for every book I read, I realized how much I didn't know. And that's what we tell our students when we teach Torah, right? The more you know about Torah, the more you realize that you don't know. Well, what about the whole world? And on one hand, it's killing Shlomo because he needs to know. But on the other hand, he knows that it's not going to completely help him. And the more he knows, the more he has to go back to his books to learn more. And is that compulsion which he finds so challenging? And that's, I believe, what we're going to see in the book, which is this constant back and forth and back and forth. This is what I think and this is what I believe. And let me demonstrate that in the actual text of the next chapter. If we go to the next chapter, and I'm not going to spend too much time on chapter 2. I really want to spend a good 20 minutes on chapter 3. But hopefully I'll be able to do that. But I just want to show you what I'm referring to So I'm going to go to video mode now and show you chapter 2. If you have it, please feel free to open up the real chapter 2. That is the chapter 2 as it shows up in your Tanakh. So let me switch over to that. And what I'd like to show you is... I'm sorry, just a second. Let's go to chapter 2. And what I'd like to show you is this conversation he's having for himself. And the language is, look for the words amarti, yadati, ra'iti, and I'll give you an example. Ra'iti ani, so I saw, but I don't think it means, I would like to propose to you that it doesn't mean I saw, it means I thought I saw, or what I observed was, or what I thought was. It's like when I say, oh, I see that. It's wiser, it's better to have knowledge than to be a fool. Because you see the light as opposed to walk in the darkness. It's like being alive versus being dead. Why? Because the wise person, the knowledgeable person, is always looking around him. He walks around in darkness. But then, yadati gam ani shenikra achad hakulam. But then I changed my mind, and then I understood, or now I understand. You see how the ra'iti, which I'm highlighting there, is not the same as the yadati, which means first I thought, based on observation, that it's better to be wise, because the wise person walks around and he has understanding of the world he's walking through. But then I understand, what difference does it make? Shemekrechad, yikrekulam, because in the end, they're all both human. The amarti. And then I said, you see that we have ra'iti, and then yadati, and then amarti is, then I came to the following conclusion. Amarti ani b'libi, mikra k'sil gam ani yikreini. Just like a fool, whatever's going to happen to him, that's going to happen to me. V'lama chacham t'yad yoteh. So why did I waste all my time becoming so wise? V'dibarti b'libi shagam zema hebel, and then I came to a conclusion that this is a waste. Now, it's not clear what this is referring to, but it could be all the chachma that I Kohelet, amassed. Nobody remembers them. Because everybody forgets your name. He cries out, how is it possible that the Chacham can die along with the Ksil? And then I hated the life that I saw. Now we're still at the beginning of the book, so Kohelet, I'm going to switch back just a second. Kohelet is still on the negative part of the book, and we'll see that things get quite a bit more positive. But I wanted to show you that language, which I think is a key to understanding Kohelet. The dibarti, vamarti, viraiti. This is what I call the thesis and the antithesis. Kohelet is not contradicting himself. He is posing an idea, he's attacking idea, he's reattacking idea, until he finally comes to a conclusion which satisfies him, if such a conclusion is easily found. And I'd like to apologize here now, because I'll show you, hopefully we'll have the time to show you, that things are not very linear. That is, either my thesis is completely wrong, because sometimes he jumps around from one idea to another idea, and what I'm asking you to expect is I propose A, and then I come back with a not A, or sometimes A. So then I say A prime, and I say not A prime. But unfortunately, sometimes I'm on A, and all of a sudden I'm on Z. However, I would like to say that books of Tanakh are written not always linearly. Sometimes different ideas connect them. In Mishlei, for instance, psukim relate only to other psukim, only based on maybe a keyword, but not an idea. In addition, I certainly don't have time to take you there, but if you take a look, one of the problems that people have with Kohelet, Iyov, is that sometimes when Iyov responds, he is not responding. This is demonstrably correct. That is, there's a series in Iyov, there's a series of conversations. Eliphaz or Bildad, they all criticize his beliefs or his approach. Then he responds to them. But sometimes in chapter 12, he may be responding to something, even though it's after what Eliphaz says to him, he may be referring back to something Eliphaz says six chapters earlier. And that really is demonstrable. Which means one of the keys to understanding Iyov is to realize that sometimes you have to wait a while to get to Iyov's answer or rejection of his friend's ideas. And here too, sometimes I think there's a bit of skipping around where Shlomo goes in different directions. Of course, that I could be just an argument that I'm trying to say because I need the book to work step A, B, C, and it doesn't. So I'm trying to say that Tanakh is not always like that. However, I believe I'm going to now, we'll spend 20 minutes or 10 minutes on chapter 3, and let's see whether we could follow a certain thought. So I'm going to take us to video. I'm sure you won't miss looking at me, and we'll look at the Tanakh instead, and we'll go to the famous chapter 3, which is really chapter 3 and 4. Remember that a Christian, Stephen Langton, is the one who put together the chapters, and by dividing chapter 3 and 4 is completely mistaken. Just a second, and I'll go to the text. And I will take us to chapter 3. Now, the one thing I'd like to do is be polemical on the top of chapter 3. The way I'm going to understand chapter 3, there's a time to live, there's a time to die. For everything on the earth, or for every person or attribute, there is a time. And desire, chefetz, I'm going to, just because we don't have the time, chefetz means God's chefetz, when he does things on this earth. The way I'm translating this whole song is really a recognition that God decides when you live and when you die, and when you're sick and when you're not sick, when you go to war and when you don't go to war. That is usually the way this song is understood, especially by the birds and by others, is that a person has to do the right thing at the right time. And that's fine. That's an acceptable translation. Far be it for me to say that that's not right, but I don't think it's right based on... I think it's not right, because if you take a look further on, you'll see that it's not really about what man desires, but it's really about what God desires. So let's just take a look at chapter 3, and what I'll show you is that there's a series of thesis and antithesis here. I just have to get up my text, since I laid it out in ways which, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to demonstrate completely, but we'll see what I can do. We'll just read through chapter 3 here a little bit, starting from verse 10. Because if you remember, verse 10 has that famous ra'iti. Do you see that word ra'iti, as I mentioned, which sort of proposes an idea? So he's saying, Ra'iti et ha'inyan, asher natan Elohim livnei Adam la'anot bo. And again, I think the la'anot is to preoccupy him with. That is, I see the occupation that God gives to man to preoccupy. Et ha'kol asah yafeh b'ito. God does everything in his own time. Ito, it's a pronoun, but I am, it's referring to God. That is, God, as I just sang, it's not up to man. It's up to God. God takes care of these things. This is a very, quote-unquote, firm approach. God even gave knowledge of the world into the hearts of man, or not the hearts, of course. Lev, as I mentioned, is the minds of man, the brains of man. With the recognition that there's no way that man is going to understand everything. That is, God made sure that was clear. That while he gave him knowledge, he also gave him an understanding that there is a limitation. Now, here's the viadati. Do you see the viadati, which usually contradicts the ra'iti? The ra'iti is very firm. God does everything fine in his time, and man is not always going to understand what happens and how that's possible. But yadati ki'im tovam ki'im l'smoach v'lasot bol chayav. However, therefore, based on the fact that you can't understand God, the best thing that you could do is just be happy with your lot in this world. You should understand that if you get a good life in this world, it's a gift that you should appreciate. That is, God takes care of everything. It's out of our ken to understand what God does. And therefore, one should really just appreciate what he has in this world and stop pondering. But yadati ki kol asher yas Elohim hu yel olam olavein losif menein legrov Elohim asam mishiru levav. God does everything in this world. Ein losif. You cannot add on to God's plan, and you can't take away from God's plan. Very fatalist approach. We're still on the same thesis, I believe. Elohim asam mishiru milafanav. And it goes a step further. But that's scary. Yeah, it's supposed to be scary. Exactly right. Now this is very critical, because what it means we're talking about here is the justice system. Yivakeshet nirdaf, he will guarantee, or he will check into, investigate, those who are chaste, which means, and we'll see in a second, that right up to now we seem just to be talking about fatalism. Everything is fate. God takes care of everything. And therefore, since God takes care of everything, then really all you have to do is be happy with your lot. Ah, but what's bothering you as a thinking person? What bothers you as a thinking person is, what about all the people who are downtrodden? When are they going to? So God's going to take care of them, but they're downtrodden. So I guarantee you, he says, Elohim nivakesh et nirdaf. Now, how do I know it's talking about the justice system? Because this next pasuk, which is, I've established my thesis. My thesis is God takes care of everything. Everything that happens in the world, time to live, time to die, time to be sick, time to heal, it's all in God's hand. And man understands that it's all in God's hand. And man understands that he can't override God. And therefore, he should simply do what he does and trust God to take care of the nirdaf, those who are downtrodden. But now he says, va'od ra'iti. Do you see, he changes his mind here. Va'od ra'iti takra shamash, but now I see while I'm alive, makom ha'mishpat shama resha, makom ha'tzedek, Shama Harasha. But here, I look at my court systems here. Man judges man here. Like, I have this theory that God takes care of all the judgment. But that's not the reality. Va'od ra'iti. I saw something else in this world. Which is, whenever I go to a court case, I see that people get a bum deal. Makom ha'mishpat shama ha'resha. And then I would hope, makom ha'tzedek shama ha'tov. But it's not. Shama yoter rasha. There's whenever I see people getting into either politics or law, or nobody, they just corrupt the system. So what good does it do me, I think Kohelet's asking, if the world is, God's going to take care of everything in the future. God is going to make everything wonderful. What good is that for me? Every time I look at the here and now, I got nothing but corrupt court systems. Amarti, now let's take a look at the next verse. So Amarti, do you see these words of switching? Amarti, ani b'limi et ha-tzadikot rasha yishpot Elohim. God will take care of the righteous and of the wrong. That is, whoever righteous in this case is the person who is deserving in the court case, and Rasha is the person who is not deserving, the person who is wrong. So God will take care of them. So let me go back to my first theory. Why? Ki eit l'chol chayfes. Do you see? That's the key that whole song up above was talking about God's desire. And chayfes means God will do what he desires when he gets there. And guarantee you that even though I go into the court cases, don't feel bad about it, because God makes sure that everything works out in the end. When they get to heaven, everything will be taken care of. As I know, on this world it stinks. It's unfair. So you should just be happy with what you have. Ah, there are people being downtrodden. God will take care of it. Ah, every time I go to a court case, he's going back and forth. Every time I go to a court case, it's another corrupt judge after corrupt judge. Don't worry about it. God will take care of making sure that the righteous are served in the future, and that the people who are unrighteous get their comeuppance, get their just rewards or unjust rewards, and that'll take care. Of course, obviously, he's talking about the future and about heaven. And now, what is the problem? Is Amarti ani b'libi al divrapnei Adam v'varam Elohim lirot shebehem ahem alahem. And this is the pasuk that we were referring to before, but now I'm going to translate, I think, a little more accurately. And yet, man is just slightly greater than animals. And here, what I think he's really referring to, and I'm disagreeing with Rashi and Rashbam and Rav Yosef Karo, that is, man selected humans, but they're only slightly above the animals. And this is, of course, the famous Tehillah, David's famous statement of Tehillah 8, Ma enosh ki tis kareyu, vatam shileyu, b'maseh adecha, that famous pasuk that we say in the Kedusha in the High Holidays, which is really saying that man is really just a little bit above, you know, on one hand he may be a little bit below the angels, but he's only a little bit above humans. And then he says, and what he's saying here is, everybody dies. Whether you're good or evil, if it's a metaphor, or whether you're an animal or a man, if it's not a metaphor, mi yodea ruach bnei adam ha'oleh hi lamala v'ruach habema ha'roedet hi lamatal aretz. Now, this is not doubting anything. How do I know that? Modern scholars, if you take the word ha'olah, there's a kamatz underneath. That is an assertion, not a question. It is wrong, based on our vowel systems, to translate. Who can know whether man's spirit goes up and whether an animal spirit goes down? Because it's ha'oleh reads, it's a fact. Now, according to modern scholars, it was all a big plot to change around the original vowels, so that's not a question, it's an assertion. But what could I tell you? this is our system, this is our Masorah, and I'm going to translate the way I read it. Which means, listen, I believe, ha'olehi lamala, that man goes up to the heavens. And the spirit of animals, ruach ha'beima, ha'yoredet hi lamata, again, it's a hey ha'yidiyah. It's an assertion that they're going to go down. But the bottom line is, mi yodea. How can you know what happens after death? That is, I think what he's trying to say is, and with all of this section is, listen, I walk into the court system, to the justice system, and I get depressed and I'm upset. And I imagine it's okay, the good will get there, you know, Ahmadinejad will get his when he goes there, and Hitler will have to pay the price when he goes to heaven, but I don't know that and I never will. And I live on this world, and all I could see is the spirit that I have in this world. And therefore, how could I really place myself and make any assertions about what's going on? I have to live in this world. And therefore, it seems to be that no one could see what's going to happen. In this world, we cannot know what happens in the world to come. And therefore, I could try to make myself comfortable and say, Ahmadinejad's going to get his, and this good person, Gib Stucka, is going to be, and Rav Soloveitchik will be have Hoshanas all over him. And we believe it's true. But that doesn't give me comfort now when I walk around and see terrible people die, good people dying before their time, and terrible people not. And here I have to close up very soon, so I'd just like to take you to the next chapter. We're not going to be able to do a whole bunch, but I'll show you in the next chapter a very important idea, and with this we'll close. And look at this word. But then when I try to make myself satisfied that I can't know what's going on, I see all the suffering. Do you see that word? V'shavti ani, I change my mind. Okay, I see all those are suffering. It's so bad that how could I ignore that there's so little justice in this world? How could I rely on my faith in the heavens when A, I can't see it, and B, there's too much suffering. It's still not fair. It's not right that things aren't taking place now. And as you can see, in my opinion, there's a conversation. He's going back and forth. And we could really spend time going into many more chapters. And there's, of course, so much more that we haven't done, but I'm going to have to close up now. So I believe that if you read Kohelet, I'll give you an example of the next chapter. There's a famous thing about how if two people work, it will be good for them. And if three people work, it's like the three bonds that are falling apart. So essentially, that first he says, listen, what good is work? It's all a failure. And then he says, good, find a partner. So again, we have thesis and antithesis. And I think that's the name of the book. And at the end of the book, the thesis that he comes up with is we fear God, we worship God, we love God, and that takes us over certain doubts that we may have. Anyway, you may all have a good night, and hopefully you'll enjoy the next year if you stay on for it. Have a good night. Signing off.
Rabbi Levy, how are you?
I'm very good, Rabbi Kelman. How are you?
Okay, thank you. We can take a minute and a half of questions, and we'll, as Dr. Lustiger like lines up to get started.
And thank you, and I see Kenneth's comment. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. There's so much more to do and so much that we could do with this about Shlomo worrying about his own children and what will be the future, and then he tries to come back with various options, but just simply too much. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me check my video. Okay. Very good. So as far, so there are a few questions here that I'll take. The first one from David Sal in Brooklyn, how can we apply Kohelet in our life? So, I try to be a biblicist, and I believe that all of Tanakh is there because it's applicable to modern life. But I have to tell you, I'm going to say something that a friend of mine, a great scholar by the name of Aaron Kohler, who is getting his PhD right now, or he's really just got his PhD from YU, said about Kohelet, which I think is brilliant, which is Kohelet is such a modern book because we all go through doubts and pain. And in my opinion, if I'm right about this book, that we see Kohelet, what pains him most is not so much what he sees, but the fact that he can't help himself by challenging himself and doubting himself. And yet he doesn't stop. He challenges himself and he challenges himself. And what you see at the very end of the book, and I would look at the end of the book, is there is great hope. Because he says, because man is limited and because we believe and fear God, you could always take chances, and what you have may work, and you could always make things better. And I think, you know, obviously this is out the scope of this class, but I think that the fact that Qohelet goes from total despair in the first chapter to really great hopefulness through a series of investigations makes me feel okay when I wake up one day and say, God, I wish God would come out in a booming voice and say, everybody should go to Israel right now, and the Jews are all right, or these people are good and these people are bad. And sometimes that absence of God is difficult. And if it bothered Shlomo, I don't feel so terrible that it bothers me sometimes also. And I'm going to pursue it as best as I can using Shlomo as a guide. Now, looking at Yisrael Kashkin, what else could happen when a person faces the most difficult crisis going back and forth? I agree with you completely, Yisrael. Yes, I agree. Shlomo or Qohelet is showing his own limitations, but I think you will see that he does come to some conclusions, Yisrael. He brings God into the picture in chapter 7. In chapter 7, he starts saying, Tov this, and Tov that, and Tov the other thing. And then in chapter 8 and 9, he really talks about the woman that you should be happy with. He takes on a very personal view, and he says, in the beginning he says, it's good that a person should be happy with his lot and enjoy eating and being happy and taking advantage in life. In the end, he says, he should appreciate all those things because it's God which allows him to have all those happy things. So there's a growth in Qohelet as well that I think is very critical, and I think we could pattern ourselves to growth. That is, he does not end up in confusion. He really ends up with some wonderful ideas, and even though all things are not solved because the world is not neat, he really comes to a great conclusion, and in my opinion, a great faith, and thank God we have this book in our Tanakh. Anyway, have a good night, and I hope you enjoy Shana Tova to all of you. K'tivach Tima Tova.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.